This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. My guests today are two people I'm honored to call colleagues. Later this hour, Steve Curwood, host of PRI's Living on Earth. He talks about his career covering first human rights and social justice, and then the environment, and how those topics are more closely linked than many realize. First, Sarah Zielinski is a freelance writer. She's author of the blog Wild Things, which appears at Science News. She also edits for National Geographic News and Science News for Students. Over the past decade, she's covered everything from astronomy to zoology for the likes of Slate, Scientific American, Science, and Discover. Sarah, welcome to Living Lab.
Thanks. I'm honored to be here.
Now, I understand that, like me, growing up, you wanted to be a marine biologist, but I think you figured out more quickly than I did that that wasn't the right career for you. So what happened?
I did a tour over at Sea Education Association here in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, and it was 6 weeks sailing in the Caribbean where I was very sick and very sleep deprived and realized this wasn't very fun for me. So after that, after I graduated, I ended up at the National Science Foundation for 5 years working on grants administration. And it's the land of lost scientists. Everyone there is looking for what to do next in their life. And so to be 22 and realize that you don't have to have it all figured out is very freeing. And eventually I just kind of came across science journalism as something that really piqued my interest, and it turns out that I was good at it, which was a nice thing to find out.
You tend to write a lot about animals, I guess still sticking a little close to that first love of biology.
Oh, biology is definitely my first love, and I've write a lot about animals. I try to write some about plants, but it's kind of hard to make plants really sing to the average reader.
Much to the dismay of botanists.
I know. Although I met some space botanists who are who make their research very interesting. But I just find this to be really fascinating. I studied ecology as an undergrad, and so these, you know, how the world is all intertwined, and this still really fascinates me. And I just happen to now be in a job where I get to learn about that and write about it and tell the world why it's so interesting.
Now, a lot of what you've been writing about in the past few years involves the idea that we are now in a new geological epoch known as
The Anthropocene.
Yeah, the age of humans, literally. What's the evidence for that, and where does that stand? How formal is that at this point?
Scientists are still arguing about that. From a geological perspective, we need to have some kind of marker in the geologic record, in the rocks, in order to define the age of humans, define the Anthropocene. If you look at, for example, the end of the Cretaceous, when the dinosaurs died, it's a really easy marker in the rock because there's a layer of an element called iridium all around the world, and it came from the asteroid that hit Earth and led to their extinction. There isn't really an equivalent yet, at least not one that scientists have agreed on. You know, there's some have proposed the beginning of the atomic age or the Industrial Revolution or when we started driving animals extinct in large numbers. But these are all things that scientists are still working out.
Now, your visit here to Woods Hole is at least in part so that you can give a lecture at the Marine Biological Laboratory that you're calling Wild Things in the Age of Humans. And when I first heard that, my first question was, are there really any wild things left? I mean, our influence is so pervasive that we're considering calling it a new geological epoch. Is there anything truly wild left?
Oh, definitely there are things that are truly wild. The question is there anything that isn't impacted by us in some way? And that might be a little harder to find. I mean, we've found traces of human impacts at the bottoms of trenches deep in the ocean.
Kinds of impacts?
There were man-made chemicals called PCBs found in little crustaceans called amphipods. An unmanned expedition, down to some of the deepest trenches in the world in 2014 found levels of PCBs that were higher than what is found in animals in some very polluted rivers in China.
Wow.
Yeah.
Not necessarily a good wow, but I mean, just amazing to realize that our influence can be so pervasive, to be so far away from where any humans go or live or work, and yet you can still find the traces of our activity pretty much anywhere.
Yeah, I mean, so there were traces of lead that showed up in at the South Pole 20 years before humans showed up there. I mean, that just blows my mind. Our chemicals ended up in places where we hadn't even, managed to get yet.
And yet somehow in a lot of your writing, you managed to, at least when I read it, convey a sense of optimism. It's not all doom and gloom, even when you're writing about those topics. Do you think that just is a reflection of your own outlook? Is that something you strive to put into your writing?
I think that if sometimes it does feel that it is a bit depressing, all of the things that I'm reading and I'm reporting on, but I think that there is a lot of opportunity still to change what we're doing, so that we can lessen our impact, What I hear often from scientists is that it's not that we don't have technological solutions to the problems that are out there. We simply lack the political will and the money to do these things. So that says to me that there's still hope out there. So it's not a hopeless situation. We can do something about all of this.
You actually wrote one piece recently that I was wildly bookmarking technologies that you were mentioning that were ways that we could not only make our houses more energy efficient, but new building materials that people are inventing that actually suck up carbon dioxide. And they were absolutely fascinating that you could make a roof out of a certain mineral that would suck up carbon dioxide, and we could make plastics that are made out of emissions. And yeah, it was one of these kinds of stories where, like you said, I mean, you have to wonder if the money is there, but certainly realizing that there are people in the world that are coming up with amazing solutions to some of these problems.
Yeah, it's simply a priority. You know, is our priority going to be, sucking as much as possible out of the earth as quickly as possible and making as much money as we can? Or is it, doing this in a more measured, wise manner so that we have people who live in the next century have an earth? An earth that is friendly to humans. We'll still have earth in 100 years, and we're not going to, completely get rid of this planet. But
you actually contribute and edit for a version of the Science News magazine that's for kids, intended target ages kind of 9 to 14, the
yes.
tween and early teen ages. I imagine that attitude and a little bit of that optimism is incredibly important, and also a lot of the kind of gee whiz and wonder of how cool a lot of the different animal adaptations in science that you write about are. That's got to be even more important when you're writing for an even younger audience.
It's very important for a couple of reasons. I mean, first of all, they're the ones who are inheriting the planet from us. And so it is very important that they know what's happening and the problems that they're going to have to tackle when they reach adulthood. But also that age range, that's when kids are really just deciding what they want to do with their lives. I mean, it's kind of crazy to think that at 10 years old, you might decide whether or not you're going to be a scientist or something else, but that is actually what happens at that age.
I was 12 when I decided I wanted to be a marine biologist, and it didn't totally work out, but it carried me through my 20s.
Yeah, so it's really important that at that age, we introduce them to good scientists and show them, show them that there are scientists like them. So we have a series on Science News for Students called Cool Jobs. And one of the things that I love about this series is, so we profile three scientists or three people who do research science on a specific area. And so one of the things that we always try to do is make sure that we don't have all just, old gray-haired white guys as the examples. Not that there's anything wrong with, with eminent scientists like that, but, for kids especially, it's important that they see people like them doing science. Because if they don't see somebody who looks like them, then they're not going to think that science is an option.
I know this is probably like asking you to choose between your children, but is there a favorite story, one of those fun, aren't animals amazing kinds of stories that you've written recently that stands out as a real favorite for you?
Recently? My favorite story ever was a story that I co-wrote for Scientific American with my friend, Kaylin Smith, who is a chicken researcher in Australia. And it was fun to collaborate with a friend, obviously. But I also learned so many things about chickens. And so now when I see a chicken, somebody has a backyard chicken, or I encountered chickens in Kauai, from writing this story and talking to my friend for many, many hours, I can tell you what they're saying based on what the sounds they're making, which is just fascinating.
It's all too tempting to ask you to speak chicken.
Well, you know that cluck, cluck, cluck sound that they're famous for? That's actually the sound that they make when they're warning of a land predator. If something's flying at them, they make a very different sound.
Hmm. Who knew? Fun facts about chickens. Sarah Zielinski is a freelance science writer, author of the science news blog Wild Things. Sarah, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You can watch a video of Sarah's lecture about wild things in the age of humans on our website, capeandislands.org. Up next, Steve Curwood on a career of covering social issues and the environment. Living Lab continues after a short break.